Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out tonight, and welcome to this next round of Constitutional Conversations. Tonight's session is the first of a two-part series examining the struggle in America for gender equality. And I'm happy to be able to do this on the occasion of Women's History Month. We don't do enough to celebrate Women's History Month. And of course, talking about women's rights goes right to the core mission of the Alturas Institute, because as you know, we promote gender equality. And we do that through a variety of ways. We have here in Idaho Falls, Conversations with Exceptional Women, which, by the way, you can circle on your calendar for this year, June 4, which happens to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the congressional passage of the 19th Amendment. So we'll be talking a lot about that here in Idaho and across America. And of course, we also promote gender equality through a similar event in Sun Valley, where we draw together remarkable women from across the country to gather for a couple of days to discuss in various ways the struggles, the challenges, the hurdles that women have faced in various sectors of American life, including those that have been overcome and those that remain. And we're working on producing yet another stellar lineup for our event. So please stay tuned for our June 4 event and then the Sun Valley event, which also I can tell you will be held on September 12 to 14. So more later on those programs. But I'm delighted you're here tonight to be able to talk about a subject that not only is one of enduring value here in America, but it's timely. Because on any given day here in America, we find that women still, in the 21st century, are the victims of gender discrimination in many, many different kinds of ways. And so tonight, I want to begin to talk about the origins and the constitutional development of women's rights in America. And I just heard from our co-sponsor, Jamin Anderson at KISU, that, in fact, tonight's program will be rebroadcast on April 22 on KISU, at beginning at 7 o'clock. It's great to have KISU as a partner because they air all of our programs. We begin then at the beginning with the familiar story that in March of 1776, as newly elected Congressman John Adams went off to the Continental Congress to begin redrafting the laws of the United States, that in fact his wife Abigail Adams, one of the leading and outstanding women advocating equal rights even in 1776, as she said goodbye to her husband, she said, "Now, as you go to rewrite the U.S. Code, please don't forget to avoid giving all power to men, because men would be tyrants if they could be." And so she said famously, "Don't forget the ladies." Well, her husband, like all of his colleagues, most men, all men, I suppose, at that time, did forget the ladies. And that meant that nothing in America with respect to the status of American women changed at all. What was the status of American women in 1776? The status simply was that the doctrine of coverture, developed in England, still applied in America. After all, we were a colony, we inherited our legal system. The doctrine of coverture was nicely spelled out by the famous English commentator, Sir William Blackstone, who had written a magisterial three-volume treatise on the laws of England. And he wrote in this commentary that under the doctrine of coverture, married women essentially had no legal status. It's as if their legal personality simply disappeared while they were married. For all intents and purposes, the man and the wife, that's how the law said it, not husband and wife, the man and the wife were in fact simply one entity, and that women at all events were under the direction of their husbands, leaving women with no legal status. No legal status, for example, to engage in contracts, to buy property, to inherit, or in the case of separation, they had no legal foundation for trying to hold on to the children. So it was a bad state of things for women. At that very time, a couple of decades later, you may recall that Charles Dickens wrote one of his famous novels called Oliver Twist. In Oliver Twist, I know this is taking you back now to high school literature, right? Where I'm sure you were assigned to read it, but probably never did. In Oliver Twist, Mr. Bumble is trying desperately to dissociate himself from the fact that his wife was found guilty of theft. And under the Doctor of Coverture, remember, the husband and the wife are a single entity. Therefore, Mr. Bumble is told, you are presumed to have a greater liability, sir, because the law presumes that the wife acts at the direction of the husband. Therefore, if the wife was guilty of theft, you, sir, are guilty of theft as well. That's when Mr. Bumble famously says, if that's the law, then the law is an ass. It's an idiot. The law, he says, is a bachelor. Let me tell you about experience. No husband directs his wife. He wrote those lines in 1839, when the book was published. So the doctrine of coverture then was well known, even notorious in England, as Charles Dickens could make fun of that doctrine. It carried over into America, and around that time, in 1848, some American reformers had had enough about the lack of rights for women, about the fact and of the imposition of coverture here in America. Those reformers met in Seneca Falls in upstate New York for what will become the first convention on women's rights. It was organized by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott. It's interesting as we talk about some of these founding mothers of America that we have to remember that those names are not as clear to us as the founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, but those names should be because these are the women who put America on their broad shoulders to try to advance the cause for gender equality. So here on July 19th and 20th in 1848 in upstate New York in the Wesleyan Chapel, Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton organized a convention. It was predominantly filled with women, but there were some brave, wise men as well, including Frederick Douglass. Almost all of the people who attended the Seneca Falls Convention were in fact abolitionists. They saw a kindred responsibility here to push abolition to free African Americans, but also it was believed to advance the cause of American women who were also placed in shackles by American law under the doctrine of coverture. The first day was devoted to speeches from women alone. And Stanton spoke, and Lucretia Mott spoke, and others spoke. And the day was filled with rousing speeches in which the women asked, why should women be treated as second-class citizens here in America? By what charter are we relegated to the class of second class? And very quickly, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott introduced what would be called the first Declaration of Women's Rights. It would actually be called the Declaration of Sentiments. And they read it to the convention. And it was virtually a mirror image of the Declaration of Independence, except it added that crucial word, women. So, for example, the beginning of the Declaration of Sentiments said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." And then went on to say, "Surely all women were intended to be covered by the Declaration of Independence and the assertion of natural rights." And they went on to pass 11 resolutions, which essentially sought to achieve for women equal social status, equal legal status, and importantly, the crucial right of women to vote. All of these resolutions were passed, although I should say, 10 of them unanimously, the 11th barely passed. What was that 11th resolution? To give women the right to vote. How about that? How could there be controversy in this great convention established to provide legal status equal to the status enjoyed by men if women are not going to be given the right to vote? There was a great debate on the question of whether women should have the right to vote. Are they knowledgeable enough? Can they free themselves from their emotions? Can they bring, excuse me, I'm just the messenger here. Please. Can they bring reason to their discussions and their views and their understandings of candidates? And on it went. Finally, as I say, it was passed. And what emerges from the Seneca Falls Convention then is this list of sentiments, a declaration of equality for women. This is the first organization to promote gender equality in America. This is in 1848. Shortly after the convention closed and the nation moved into the Civil War, the arguments about abolition and the status of women tended to split American women and proponents of abolition and gender equality. A first group emerged, led by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, and they formed this organization to promote equality, but they were a little bit angry. No, let me say it this way. They were a lot angry about the fact that those promoting abolition in this country had done so at the expense of women's rights. In other words, they had created political coalitions to achieve the goal of civil rights for Black Americans, particularly the 15th Amendment right to vote, at the expense of promoting gender equality. So they were angry, they were confrontational. Other American women didn't like the confrontational politics, so they split from Elizabeth Cady Stanton and from others who were in that group. And headed by Lucy Stone, they decided that what they ought to do is to side with Republicans. In these days, these were the so-called radical Republicans, very progressive Republicans, I should say, that were responsible for promoting the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment. They would reach their heyday, they would reach their high watermark, by the way, in 1876, and so many of them would be defeated at the polls that the time of progressive politics as a dominant feature of the Republican Party would come to an end. But they deserve, obviously, great historic credit for promoting the 14th Amendment, equal protection of the law, due process of law, and then on the 15th Amendment guaranteeing blacks the right to vote. But the ideological and tactical differences, as I say, split the groups, and so they couldn't work very effectively to continue to fight for the right of women to vote. What organization can be split roughly down the middle and still succeed in achieving the goal? Fine, and so a number of tactics were undertaken. So Susan B. Anthony, for example, gets arrested in Rochester, New York in 1872 for voting, for daring to vote. She was, of course, violating the law when she tried to cast a ballot in the U.S. House of Representatives race. She was charged with knowingly and willfully voting. I guess you do know if you're going to vote. She was found guilty, fined $100, but she vowed she would never pay a penalty. She then turned around and sent a petition to Congress to say that the state law prohibiting women from voting was morally repugnant, and asked Congress in this petition to pass a law to overturn it. Obviously, she didn't win, but she was busy fighting the good fight. And so on into the 1870s, the battle for women's suffrage is raging. And women are marching, they're speaking, they're lobbying, they're engaging in civil disobedience as a means of trying to win their right to vote. It's slow going, very tough sledding, because remember, the people in power that they're trying to persuade to extend the franchise are old white men, sexist old white men, who are not of the mind to grant the right to vote to women. Meanwhile, alongside this battle to win suffrage is another very great battle, a battle which is viewed by women as one of equal importance to achieving their freedom. And this is the battle for freedom to use contraceptive devices. From the 1850s into the 60s and 70s, some women had been waging a battle in the Northeast, particularly in New York and Connecticut, to try to persuade legislators that, in fact, women should have access to contraceptive devices. Why? Well, they made arguments that are familiar to us today, novel in their time, and they included the fact that without contraceptives, women would endure many, many pregnancies, which they would say would shorten their lives because it would burden women, leave them in ill health, impose some disabilities, and premature death. In addition, it was pointed out, without access to contraceptives, women would not be able to go to school. Because they married so young, they would have no education. In addition, they would never be able to pursue any kind of a profession. And remember, at Seneca Falls, one of the arguments made is that women should have the right to pursue education, to pursue a profession, and the right to vote. So women at the forefront of the drive for access to contraception are well aware of the fact that without that access, their quality of life is going to be diminished, and their opportunity to achieve education or to pursue a career will be nil. So it's interesting to watch that on the one hand, women are fighting for the right to vote, because without the right to vote, they cannot make a difference, and without access to contraceptives, they can't participate in the political system. One goes with the other then. And so women are mindful of the fact of what Elizabeth Cady Stanton had said at Seneca Falls, that we are being denied the fundamental right that had led our forefathers to revolt against England, namely, we are governed without our consent. We are taxed without our consent. We don't have any voting representation for us, anybody leading the charge for voting rights or access to contraceptives. So in the same way that women engaged in speeches and marches and lobbying and civil disobedience in the fight for suffrage, they do the same in the name of access to contraceptives. And women in New York and Connecticut are going to jail by the droves for that fight. So you talk about citizen activism from the mid-19th century forward, we see it primarily now in the form of fighting for gender equality. Slow going, tough sledding, as I say, their audience is one that is not particularly interested in their struggles. Why not? Because white male legislators, didn't matter if it was in Connecticut or New York or any place else, believe that women didn't have a right, nor did they have the equipment to participate in the political arena. It was a very backward view of women. Women were essentially put on earth by God, it was argued, to run the household, to stay in the kitchen, and tend to family needs. That was their purpose. they fared no better in the courts. And here we take an interesting turn now to see how not only the Supreme Court of the United States, but some state courts responded to claims by women about the 14th Amendment rights and the right of suffrage. Our story with respect to early constitutional development really begins with the 1873 case called Bradwell versus Illinois, featuring Myra Bradwell, who had a law degree, moved from Vermont to Illinois, and she fully intended to practice law. She was, by all accounts, more than eminently qualified, as bright as any man, very capable. When she applied for a law license in Illinois, a three-judge panel consisting of men denied her the request. She was told, "We women don't practice law in Illinois." So she immediately filed suit. She filed suit to the Illinois Supreme Court, and of course she was rebuffed. The Illinois Supreme Court pointed out that Illinois does not have any female barristers, as they were called, and not only our state law denies it, but common law, the Illinois court wrote, common law inherited from England is very wise because England did not have female barristers either. And so she loses in the Illinois Supreme Court. What to do now? Because she had claimed that the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause gave her a right to practice a lawful calling, she now had an automatic right to appeal to the Supreme Court. So let's look at what her constitutional argument was. When we look at the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868, we're familiar with the language that says no state shall make or enforce any law denying the equal protection of the law, due process of law, or privileges and immunities of citizenship of the United States. That last clause is the important one here. Again, no state shall make or enforce any law denying to any person the privileges and immunities of citizenship of the United States. Myra Bradwell had said to the Illinois court, "By virtue of the fact that I'm a citizen, I have a right to pursue a job, an occupation, a career, a lawful livelihood, a way of earning a living." When the case comes to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1873 in Bradwell versus Illinois, she loses again. There was one dissenting justice, Chief Justice Davis, but he wrote no opinion. He just dissented, so we don't know what was going through his mind. We don't know. The other justices, however, rejected her claim about a 14th Amendment right to practice law. The first thing that the court pointed out was, following a case that the court had just decided that very term, that same year, the court has said that that the Privileges and Immunities Clause does not include within its compass a right to practice law. There's nothing about the 14th Amendment, the court said, that added to the corpus or the body of privileges and immunities the right to practice law. So we reject your 14th Amendment claim. Moreover, the court said, it is left to each individual state in the union to decide for itself who might practice law, who might be able to enjoy this occupation, who might be able to pursue this particular job. Each state, the court reminded, is left to exercise its broad police powers. Every state has broad police powers. What are police powers? The broad authority inherent in each state to pass laws to promote the health, morals, welfare, and safety of its citizenry. State legislators then are left to their own devices to determine what constitutes the health, the morals, the welfare, and safety of their residents. And that could be used for good purposes, that could be contracted to narrow purposes to deny women the right to pursue a lawful calling. So having said that, the court then, as I say, firmly rejected Myra Bradwell's plea for the opportunity to practice law. Justice Joseph Bradley's concurring opinion is notorious because it's in this opinion where he goes beyond the court's focus on the legal question to wax broadly about the role of women in American life. Here he reiterates all of the sentiments that lay behind the doctrine of coverture, and he's worse. This is in 1873, not in the 17th century, 100 years before, when the doctrine of coverture really took hold in England. And he reminds everyone, as he writes, that the Creator put women on earth for specific purposes, to tend to family needs, to cook, to raise the children, to tend to the household. And, he wrote, women possess a delicate, timid nature, and it's right that they do, and because they do have this delicate, timid nature, they are not, he said, they are not equipped to practice law, where all of the ugly parts of life come before the courts. And he ticked off the fact that people can engage in murder and rape and larceny and all kinds of crimes, all of which, he said, should not be factors or behavior that women have to confront. The idea that women should be behind a fence, locked off from all of the ugly world, protected so that they can tend to their duties at home. It's hard to believe, perhaps, in the year 2019 that a Supreme Court justice could have written that way about women. But what's harder to believe is that view, expressed by Justice Bradley, held sway well into the 1950s in America. From 1873 into the 1950s, there was virtually an unbroken line of thought among the justices about the timid, delicate nature of women who require protection by the government. How was this manifested? Well, I just mentioned the 1873 Bradwell case. About that same time, a year or so later, when a woman, Mrs. Minor, brought a lawsuit to claim the right to vote, the court said again, rejecting the right to vote, saying there is no constitutional right for women to vote, and there is no constitutional coverage for the claim or the assertion itself. The 14th Amendment, the court said, contemplates the right of men to vote, but nothing in the Constitution about the right of women to vote. And the court goes on, besides, women with their delicate nature should not participate in the ugly, bruising world of American politics. Another rejection. Move forward a couple of years, and now the court seeks to protect women not because of their equality, but because of the court's perception of their inferiority. So, beginning in the 1890s, a number of states begin to pass laws known as maximum working hour laws, trying to protect workers, particularly those who are working in the mines and they can develop black lung or brown lung disease, or those working in the mills subjected to very dangerous conditions. And the supposition is that the longer somebody is working in those dangerous conditions, the greater likelihood that they'll suffer an injury or a disease. So state legislators now, beginning in the 1890s, as I say, pass legislation to try to impose maximum working hour laws for the protection of all workers. But the Supreme Court strikes down these laws, saying under what was known as the court stated in 1905, as the liberty of contract doctrine. It is entirely up to workers to decide how many hours a week they want to work, under what conditions, at what wages, and the state cannot intervene under the name of protecting workers, which the court perceived as a red flag that is flying the flag of socialism. We cannot have the state entering the economy to try to protect American workers from their own choices. But the one exception was, in a 1908 case coming out of Oregon, Muller versus Oregon, the Supreme Court upheld a maximum working hour law for women to protect women from working more than 40 hours a week. And what was the rationale? Women are weak, they're inferior, it is our good cause to protect the child bearers in our country. So if the state sees fit to limit the number of hours that women can work, that can be sustained, but not laws that would limit the number of hours worked for men. So here is the beginning of the court's jurisprudence that would put women not on a pedestal, as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would say many years later, but in a cage. Not on a pedestal, but in a cage, depriving women of their rights to choose and to make decisions, and promoting the idea that women are timid and weak and inferior and need protection by the state. Once that doctrine is unleashed in America, then, now it's creating, it's reaffirming this view of women as second-class citizens. So you see, up until this point, well into the 1930s, the fact that women had been dealt their fate from the bottom of the deck from 1776 forward has not undergone any change. It's hard enough to believe that women would be treated in this manner in the early part of American history, but perhaps even more difficult to understand that on into the 1940s and the 1950s, women are still denied the right to pursue a lawful calling. So consider in 1948, a case comes before the Supreme Court called Grosshart versus Cleary, involving a law in Michigan that prohibits women from being bartenders unless it is the wife of the owner or the daughter of the owner, which is permissible on the assumption that dad or husband will always be at the bar to protect wife or daughter. But any other woman should not be allowed to tend bar. And the thought there in Michigan, as in many other states, was that if women are in the bars, it will only promote immorality and promiscuity. So the state has to use the police power to protect women from themselves, from their own inability to make good choices, from their own inability to look at facts and circumstances and make good decisions. When the case reached the Supreme Court in 1948, the court took a dim view of the argument that the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause protected the rights of women to pursue the same jobs that were held by men. In a pretty curt, offensive opinion, Justice Felix Frankfurter addressed the question, why should there be a difference between men and women? And here's how Frankfurter addressed that question. He said, to ask that question is to answer it. If you have to ask that question, why there should be a double standard, then you are really living life under a stone, reiterating the fact that women have a different nature, they need protection, so forth. So across the country then, state after state, passed laws prohibiting women from tending bar, and there was a similar case here in Idaho in the 1950s in which the state Supreme Court upheld that similar reasoning and prohibited women from from participating as a bartender. But I will note, very interestingly, there was a member of the Idaho Supreme Court who dissented and invoked the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause that said that the law cannot prohibit a woman from practicing the same livelihood as that pursued by a man. That was, for its time, a very progressive view, and that Idaho Supreme Court justice who dissented would, in fact, be a rarity in America, and he sets a path of a few other judges in Idaho in years to come who will invoke similar reasoning, which we'll return to a little bit later. So women can't tend bar, and they are allowed to be servers, by the way, because that won't necessarily lead them to go near the bar, and certainly not behind the bar. Don't ask me to draw the distinctions there. Interestingly, around that same time period, in 1956 in Oregon, the state of Oregon, progressive Oregon, passed a law that prohibited women from wrestling. No professional wrestling for women. What was the thinking? Not clear that there was any, but women were not allowed to wrestle. When the case goes to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of Oregon, the Oregon court upheld it, of course, but poked fun at the lawmakers and suggested that maybe the lawmakers simply want to maintain an island in the sea that is exclusively male. They fear that too much of their lives now has been invaded by females, and they need to protect that last preserve, that little island in the sea. But the court sustained it. Why? Again, on the basis of the fact that a state legislature enjoys broad police powers to determine what constitutes the health, morals, welfare, and safety of its citizens, and it had determined that the specter of women wrestling in the public was clearly immoral. So, women can't wrestle, they can't tend bar, they can't even serve on juries. In 1961, the U.S. Supreme Court said there are good reasons for states to deny women from service on a jury, even though in our country we believe that participation in a jury is a very democratic way of providing civic opportunities to all Americans, and we place great stock in that process, that you are judged by your peers, all peers, it seems, except women. What was the rationale by the Supreme Court in 1961 for upholding the authority of states to deny women the right to participate on a jury? Women are busy at home tending to the kids and running the household business in 1961. So it's pretty grim, isn't it? It will not be for another 10 years until 1971 when the Supreme Court in Reed versus Reed, a case coming out of Idaho, will strike down a state statute on grounds that it violates the Equal Protection Clause because it promotes gender discrimination, which we'll get to. But before we go further chronologically, I want to go backward to return to the right to vote for a moment, because remember, we had this fork in the road where women are pursuing the right to vote, the suffrage, at the same time they're pursuing access to contraceptive devices so that they can be liberated in the sense that they can then go to school, they can have jobs, they won't be burdened with 15 or 20 pregnancies, their lives won't be shortened, they won't be burdened with bad health and all the rest. And most importantly, they could choose whether or not they want to bear children. That's a crucial factor. So even in the 1860s, the argument being made by women that they have a right to choose how to govern their reproductive organs, pretty powerful argument made a long time ago. Legislators in Connecticut and New York are particularly concerned when they hear that women, if they gain access to contraceptive devices, could actually make a choice about having sex with their husbands. And the legislators take a dim view about the alternative to procreational sex that's being represented here in theory in what we would call recreational sex. The legislators don't like that because, of course, they take the view that it's a husband's choice and a wife's duty. Again, I'm not saying this. And so they feel threatened by the fact that if women gain access to contraceptive devices and they can go to school and they can work, that they might then be competing with men for those jobs at the same time that they believe that their world would be under siege if, in fact, the women can vote, because then, Lord help us, they'll be voting and they may even choose to run for office, and then we'll see lambs lying down with lions and the world coming to an end. The right to vote then, first pursued as early as 1848 in the Seneca Falls Convention, doesn't make much headway until it's introduced in Congress in 1878. A bill is introduced that early, it doesn't gain any traction. But now, as women become better organized, they begin to march, they're lobbying very hard for the right to vote. By 1912, one dozen states have already given women the right to vote in their state elections. And our neighbor to the east, Wyoming, by the way, was the first state in the Union to give women the right to vote. That was in 1869. Wyoming will be celebrating its 150th anniversary of the right to vote next fall. As the momentum builds then, with the fact that states are granting women the right to vote, in 1917, when New York adopts a bill to grant women the right to vote, President Woodrow Wilson now changes his mind. He had been watching the whole right of women's suffrage very closely. When he saw New York go over the top and grant women the right to vote, he then believed that he was on the wrong side of history, and he came out publicly for the right to vote. And then very quickly, the momentum built up. And Congress in the House of Representatives in early 1919 passed the bill overwhelmingly, something like 305 to 80, to grant women the right to vote. The Senate adopted that same legislation a few weeks later. At any rate, on June 4, 1919, as I say, Congress passed the bill that would become the 19th Amendment. It would finally be ratified in August of 1920, giving women the right to vote. So a very long history of women fighting for the right to vote so that they could be full-fledged citizens. We talk all the time about the great importance in the United States of having the right to vote, a great way to demonstrate your individual sovereignty, a great way to register your particular views and your opinions, and a way to exercise your power as a citizen. If you are deprived of the right to vote, you are essentially stripped of the key elements of citizenship, which is why, quite frankly, now the voter repression laws in states and the great debate before the Supreme Court right now about gerrymandering goes right to the core of American democracy. If some American voters are denied their right to vote, it is an all-out attack on American democracy. So women win this right to vote, and then, of course, they begin to run for office slowly. But they do not win at the same time. In 1920, they have yet to win the other battle, the right to have access to contraceptives and all that it means if they are denied contraceptives. That battle is not finally won until 1965. Doesn't that just seem like yesterday? 1965, when the Supreme Court in Griswold versus Connecticut finally upholds the assertion that women have a constitutional right as a matter of privacy to use contraceptive devices. This is a great case, a landmark case that comes out of Connecticut, the same state that for 100 years had consistently denied the efforts by women to access contraceptives. The long and short of it, and this is a great case study of American constitutional law at work, in the long and short of it is that the state of Connecticut had prohibited women from granting access to contraceptives. Finally, there is a lawsuit brought together by a couple of scholars at the Yale Law School, a Planned Parenthood, a physician who dispenses the birth control pill, and a couple that wants to have access to it. So a good combination. When the case reaches the Supreme Court, the opinion for the court is written by Justice William O. Douglas, who heralds from Yakima, Washington. Douglas lived such a broad and great career that at the end of his life, he decided he needed two volumes to write about his life. A single volume wouldn't be enough in an autobiography. He needed two volumes. So he wrote two volumes about his life. At any rate, he was a character, Wild Bill Douglas. But he had a real libertarian streak in him that carried him through his early days in politics, his participation in politics, and finally onto the judiciary. Here's a short 2-minute biography of Justice William O. Douglas. In the classroom, I've always told my students, we will refer to Justice Douglas as William O. with affection. In the same way, I told my students when we referred to Thomas Jefferson, it's TJ. We're going to bring him right home here. It's TJ and it's William O. At any rate, Douglas was born into extreme poverty, brilliant, had a photographic memory. When he finished his undergraduate education in Western Washington, he was accepted to law school at Columbia, but he had no money to get there. And so when he decided the only way to get there was to ride the rails, that is to say, not buying a ticket, jumping on the railroad cars and trying to escape the railroad police, whom he referred to as bulls, he knew he was risking his life because he saw how others had been beaten by the railroad bulls, and so he was taking his life in his hands. He reached New York, didn't have any money, but he was so bright that he earned his first dollars by tutoring people in law school, even though he had yet to start law school. Pretty impressive. At any rate, he cruises through. He goes on to win the affection of Franklin Roosevelt. He is named chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, heralded by everybody as very, very bright. He was known as a very progressive justice of the Supreme Court and believed always that, in fact, the Bill of Rights should be interpreted in a way to rein in governmental action, and the court should not show very much deference to governmental action, that its first duty was to uphold the Bill of Rights. So, with that tease about William O. Douglas, when the case comes before the court in Griswold versus Connecticut, he writes the opinion and he strikes it down by introducing a new concept called penumbral rights. And he believes that the denial of access to contraceptive devices violates the Bill of Rights in any number of areas. So he said, for example, and penumbral rights is simply a fancy word for implied rights. We have in our Constitution, as you know, certain enumerated rights, those that are spelled out. First Amendment says, for example, Congress shall make no law abridging free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press. We have the Second Amendment spelled out, et cetera, et cetera. But there are some implied rights or rights which can be fairly derived from those rights that are enumerated. We call them implied rights. Justice Douglas referred to them as penumbral rights. So what are they? He would say, for example, that the case of a woman denied access to contraceptives would violate a First Amendment right, because when we have the right of free speech, which is enumerated, that right contemplates our right to think our thoughts, to decide where we stand on issues, and to act on our beliefs. Therefore, if we want to access contraceptives and the government denies it, it's violating, in a broad sense, our right to freedom of speech. He said it's also violating our right of freedom of religion, because freedom of religion, enumerated in the First Amendment, contemplates an implied right, or a penumbral right, in which we have the opportunity to think about our connection with the universe or our relationship with a creator. Any action that would impinge upon that is also a violation of a First Amendment right. And particularly, he points to freedom of assembly. Freedom of assembly would include the right to decide whom we're going to hang out with or whom we're going to associate with in our bedroom. And so a denial of access to contraceptives impinges on that. He goes through the Bill of Rights then, but he also says that there's a violation of the right to privacy, which he finds to inhere in the Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendment the 14th Amendment Liberty Clause, that a denial of our liberty is a violation of our right to due process of law. So he strings these together, finds that we have a right to use contraceptives, and refers to, quote-unquote, the sacrosanct precincts of the marital bedroom. And Douglas, who was a very earthy Westerner, had a real earthy sense of humor, also wrote in his opinion, "I wonder how the Connecticut police are going to enforce this law anyway. Are they going to be peering through windows?" So you get the gist of that. So at any rate, the court then, for the first time in our history, finally holds that married couples have a right to access contraceptive devices. Married couples, not unmarried couples. Now, this is a bit of a problem because the year's 1965, and from reading the history books, I understand this is the period of the sexual revolution in America, and probably more than married couples are seeking access to contraceptive devices. The court cures that problem the next year, extends that right to contraceptive devices to unmarried couples as well. So the long quest for women to access contraceptives is finally achieved in 1965, and then a year later in 66. That's a very long struggle for women to have access to a fundamental right, just as their long battle to achieve the right to vote was a historic and long-fought battle. It reminds us that, in fact, rights have to be earned. Nobody's ever given any rights in America. Blacks have had to struggle for their rights. Women have had to struggle for their rights, except for a few rich, privileged white males at the beginning. Everybody else has had to fight to earn their rights. And that is a great lesson for all Americans, that if you want to achieve liberty and you want to win rights, then you don't have a choice but to lobby, to speak, to write, to march, and perhaps engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, which, of course, was the great tactic employed by Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm going to stop here, saving a lot of rich material for next week, which will barely give us enough time to scratch the surface on the battle for gender equality. But I'm happy now to take any questions, or because this is still a democracy, to entertain any criticisms and comments that you might have. I think Kelly's got the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Perhaps a little bit of a complicated question, but the Supreme Court with a conservative majority is quite possible if not likely, but it's certainly possible they could strike down the right to abortion, which is based upon the assumption of the right to privacy and the privacy between a woman and her doctor. If that is struck down, does it not also bring into question a woman's right to privacy in the selection of contraceptives?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. Thank you. So as we contemplate what this court, as currently constituted, might do, or any future court might do, we begin with the understanding that the Supreme Court has in the past and may well again overturn some of its previous rulings. So most Americans were thrilled, for example, in 1954 in the landmark case of Brown versus Board of Education when it overturned the 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which upheld segregation. Americans were thrilled, most were, when the court held in 54 that segregation is unconstitutional. How would Americans respond if, in fact, this court begins to undermine the woman's right to an abortion as established in Roe versus Wade, maintained in every single Supreme Court decision since then, albeit with a few tweaks? How would Americans feel then if Roe is overturned and, to your question, not merely the right of abortion, but the right of privacy? Judge Robert Bork, who was a Ronald Reagan nominee, defeated. He was rejected in his bid to gain a Supreme Court seat, mirrored the length and breadth of conservative thought here in America when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee and said, the Constitution contemplates no right to privacy. Thus, he would have junked Griswold versus Connecticut. So if, in fact, the court would overturn Roe versus Wade, would it go further and overturn Griswold versus Connecticut and its progeny and hold that there is no constitutional right to vote? Here is the concern. We understand that the court can overturn its previous decisions. Sometimes we become nervous when the complexion of the court changes and you have people who are committed to a particular ideology or program. What happens to our protections at that point in time? In the same way, we saw just a couple of years ago that the court essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was the key to protecting the voting rights of African Americans. We have good reason to wonder where the court might go. And here, just yesterday, day before, you might have read some newspaper accounts of the oral argument before the Supreme Court in these very important gerrymandering cases involving North Carolina and Maryland. The gist of the problem is that if political parties in control of their state politics are able to impose a stranglehold on the state party politics by virtue of the fact that they can redraw congressional districts in a way that is a gross form of gerrymandering, it will make it virtually impossible for the opposition party to ever win another political race, meaning a permanent entrenchment of the majority party in a particular state. The argument in oral argument yesterday before the court was the court should not enter this political thicket because once it does, then it will never be able to escape. And Justice Ginsburg shot right back and said, that's what we were told in One Man, One Vote, that if we enter the political thicket, we'll never be out. But One Man, One Vote maintains voting equality in this country. People are only supposed to have one vote. Nobody gets less than a vote. Nobody gets more than a vote. That was a brave decision by the Supreme Court. So you ask a really great question, not only one that focuses on abortion rights or perhaps contraceptive rights, including the right to privacy, but the broader question about what any court is capable of doing in terms of rewriting American constitutional history. Did you have a follow-up or did I answer that okay? Oh, good. Thank you. Where are we, Kelly? Oh, yeah, please.
It seems that there's a great tension between cultural practice and
law, okay? As you look back over history, as societies become more pluralistic, how do you really manage the influence of culture on law and law on culture?
That's a great question that scholars have written about over the years in books and many, many articles. Historically, we say that the law runs behind cultural changes. There's always a historical lag, and so the law has to hurry to catch up with shifting norms, shifting values. What happens if we have a culture that's out in front of the law and begins to move away from the all-important democratic norms, moving away from an interest in protecting civil rights and civil liberties? What course does the law take at that point? That's one question. A second question is, which institutions are responsible for changing the law or bringing the law up to speed with those cultural changes? The first obvious answer would be that we expect Congress to do that, but what if Congress is not interested in doing it? Then does it fall to the courts to do it? If the court tries to bring law up to date to reflect changing laws, then the court is going to be besieged with criticisms that it's an activist court, that it's overstepping its role. So let me give you an example. I referenced in 1954 the landmark case of Brown versus the Board of Education, where the court held that segregation in public schools is unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So in sum, you cannot engage in segregation. While that was widely popular, it was also deeply divisive because critics said it's not the role of the Supreme Court to update the Constitution to keep it current with changing needs or changing demands. That's the role of the legislative body. And if the court is viewed as an instrument or an agency that tries to update the Constitution, revising it in light of what the justices believe America needs, is that not converting the court into a super legislature, where the justices then are free to follow their own political views? And so critics could say, just even though lots of Americans were happy to overturn segregation, would they also be willing to give the right to 9 other justices who might have very conservative views or old-fashioned views, not, for example, entertaining a right to abortion or a right to contraceptives, or even same-sex marriage, for example. So criticisms brought by scholars about institutional behavior are very important, and we might say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So you've just asked a very important question that people have written lots of articles and books about. But I would say that if the American public decides through discourse and national debate that it's time for same-sex marriage, for example, then we would hope that the court would see clear that, in fact, the 14th Amendment would, in fact, embrace same-sex marriage. But what if the court does that, brings the country up to a current norm, but there's still a third of the country or more that doesn't like it? That means that the court is going to be heavily criticized. And so there's no doubt that the court is caught in the crosshairs of great controversy in the past couple years, and likely will in the next few years, as we contemplate what it should or shouldn't do. And there's a clear line between the so-called conservatives and the progressives on the court, and people are nervous about what this current court may do. Thanks. I need about 15 more hours to answer your question, but I hope that helped. Where are we? Oh, Veronica, please.
I was wondering, so we've heard so many cases about the struggle to pursue a career, pursue a specific job, but I was wondering, especially with the Illinois case, how did the women get the opportunity for education? So how in the first place did the person become a lawyer that she then could not use that knowledge.
Right. So how is it that a woman could be deprived of pursuing her career as a lawyer and using that knowledge that she utilized, that she acquired during school? Is that it? Oh, go ahead.
Yes, but also, so why is there this division that she could get the education, but still couldn't do anything about it? How could they get into schools? What was then the division between the profession and the education?
Yeah, very good point, because, I'm glad you've raised it, because one of the great criticisms of the court decisions that would deny women the right to practice law, for example, or others, is to ask, why do we have an educational system where people acquire knowledge in medicine, in law, and other areas, and then we deny them the right to practice what they've acquired? It doesn't make sense, does it? So it took a long time to shake the justices out of their very old anachronistic views. Would the answer be, well, let's not even have women go to school because we're not going to allow them to pursue these jobs in the first place? So it's a hard nut to crack, this nut of sexism that was embodied by and among Supreme Court justices way back then, and I dare say to some extent to this day. It's a real problem. Yeah. Thank you.
Did she earn her law degree in Illinois?
She earned her law degree in Vermont. She came and then practiced in Vermont and then came to Illinois. So she was well qualified. So why would she not be able to practice her craft? Why would she not be able to utilize the information that she had worked to acquire?
Even in this age, there are still states that don't have reciprocal agreements. So having certification in a trade in one state does not guarantee you the right to work in another state.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Although through Article 4 of the Constitution now, we believe that states would have to have a very powerful reason to deny people the right to practice their craft in other states. Yeah, fortunately. It took a while to get there. Back there, please.
Recall correctly, there used to be laws saying that if a married woman delivered a child, the child was her husband's. When did that change? That addresses like the cultural aspect getting ahead of the law?
Yeah, good question. So under the doctrine of coverture, you're exactly right that if a man and a woman separated, the children would be the responsibility, the heirs of the man, and the woman had no right. So it was not until we broke free from the doctrine of coverture and women began to earn some rights to acquire property, inherit money, and to win the children, all of which didn't even begin to occur until the late 40s in this country and on into the 50s, and still states had to go through an exhaustive change to remedy those old remnants of coverture. So family law is one of those areas which is deeply contested, very controversial, but the reality is that until women were freed from the doctrine of coverture, they had no right to the children.
Yeah, the concern I have is with the deeply earned rights for privacy, for contraception or abortion. So those things are deeply ingrained in modern society. Yeah. So to me, for a group of justices to revert that, wouldn't they think that they'd have a violent reaction to that? I mean, this is not something to be taken lightly, and I don't think people would take that very lightly.
I think that's a very good point. Justice Douglas, for example, in Griswold versus Connecticut in 65, could say, as you point out, that it was assumed in American life that married couples had a high degree of privacy in their bedrooms. Just simply assumed, and this goes back to your point, at what point will the law catch up with that norm, with that understanding? The reality is that state laws range widely across the country with respect to what might be done and what couldn't be done in an adult bedroom. That took a lot of case law to straighten out. And you're right, if suddenly the court were to overturn Roe versus Wade, which again, has never been overturned, and the central premise of Roe has been upheld even by conservative members of the Supreme Court, which led a Pennsylvania senator, the late Arlen Specter, to refer to Roe versus Wade as, quote, a super-duper precedent. Super-duper. Not just a strong, not just a solid, but a super-duper precedent, to your point that there would be a great public outrage if that right were undercut or removed. It could happen, though. There are cases in the pipeline continuing to try to eat away at the right to a woman's right to choose. What would be the reaction? You ask a very important question. The court, we've always said, judicial scholars have always said, is very concerned to protect its reputation. And that's because the court recognizes it has no power except its reputation. I say no power because, A, it cannot enforce its own decisions. That's left to the executive branch at any level, the state level or the national level. And it lacks the power of the purse. So it's entirely incumbent upon the goodwill that it's earned with the American public to see that its decisions are embraced or implemented. So if the court were to register a decision that would cause an uproar, such as overturning Roe versus Wade, it would stand to plummet in the eyes of America, and its power hinges on its reputation. Without that reputation, its prestige would plummet. It would lose its power. What would that mean? There would be fewer reasons for people to obey the Supreme Court decisions. And that's the last thing the court wants to have happen. And so it understands that when it writes opinions, it's writing opinions that we hope would be understood and followed by the American people. But if it loses its prestige, then the court would have to fear that its decisions would not be followed. Where are we? Oh, please.
So you said that women were basically the property of their husbands. They didn't own the children. They didn't own the property. I've seen in my ancestors' wills the daughters being left certain things. Is that because they were not married? So if they were not married, they could own it. Is that correct?
Yeah, good question. Thank you. That's exactly right. Married women lost what we call their legal personality. They had no legal standing. They were merged with their husband, and that meant that they were acting under the direction of the husband. But unmarried women would have rights. This seems a little bit odd, doesn't it? So the way to maintain some independence would be to remain unmarried. Yes, that's right. Oh, yeah, Dan, please.
I believe there was some news recently on the ERA.
Oh, I believe there was some news on the ERA recently. That's been getting states support for decades, but it's still falling short. What happens, I mean, maybe there'll be a President Harris or a President Warren or something, and there might be a renewed effort, and maybe a few more states will approve it. Is there any deadline? What do you foresee happening?
Yeah, that's a great question. The ERA, that is ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, first proposed in 1972, is now very close to being adopted. Remember, under the Constitution, that we have to have 3/4 of the states adopting it, and so that would mean 38. Well, we're on the threshold of achieving that, except some states rescinded their ratification. So that would mean, for example, if they rescinded their ratification years ago, it might be argued that their vote once upon a time in favor of the ERA should not count. So what that means would be legal battles, courtroom battles to determine whether or not a state may rescind its ratification. I think a state cannot rescind its ratification. Once approved, the state is stuck with that. Here's why. If a state may rescind, that is, take away its ratification of a proposed constitutional amendment, think of the chaos that would be introduced in the country. On Tuesday, Idaho and Montana and Wyoming stick with the ERA, and then on Thursday they change their minds. What's the status? And on Friday, New York and Connecticut and Florida. It would be utter chaos. I think that that the preamble of the Constitution, in order to create a more perfect union, provides guidance here. Allowing states to rescind their ratification of a constitutional amendment would not create a more perfect union, but a terribly distressed, disorderly nation. But in answer to your question, that kind of lawsuit would come before the Supreme Court to decide ultimately, wow, that would be a big one. I do believe that it's still important for the country to ratify the ERA, to not only state with clarity that women enjoy equal rights, but also there is a certain symbolical value. Even though that's not as important as the strict statement of equal rights, it would be a clear declaration that, in fact, women may not be the victim, may not be denied opportunities, jobs, be denied equal pay, et cetera, because of their gender. We need that kind of statement. As Justice Ginsburg often likes to see, she would like her granddaughter to be able to see in the Constitution a statement of equality for women. I think that's important, yeah. Any other questions or comments? Criticisms? We save criticisms for the end of the program, but I'm sorry, we're out of time now for that. So thank you very much for your comments and questions. I look forward to seeing you next week as we take up more. Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to KISU for broadcasting this. Thanks, Jamie.